Hello and welcome to the Jacobite Podcast, Episode 15, The Return of the King. So, welcome back and a fond welcome to 2021. This episode is the first of a new year and an end to 2020. 2020 will forever be known in the future as the starting point of the Jacobite Podcast, and other than that, we shall never speak of it again. When we left our narrative, James Stuart, the Jacobite claimant to the thrones as King James III of England and 8th of Scotland, was preparing to sail from his European exile. He had sat in port at the French town of Saint-Malo from November 1715, as the weather had prevented him from crossing the Channel. But by December, and disguised as a deckhand, James made his way by boat, evading British naval patrols and feared assassination attempts. The Jacobite king in exile arrived in Peterhead, just off the coast of Aberdeenshire, on the 22nd of December, 1715. James wrote back to Bolingbroke, his Secretary of State, to inform him that, "I am at last, thank God, in my kingdom. I find things in a prosperous way." This might have been a rather optimistic statement, given that 1. To this point, the Jacobite forces had fought 2 military engagements, one in Preston and one in Sheriffmuir, and not won either of them. Preston had resulted in the English Jacobites surrendering, while Sheriffmuir didn't have a definitive result, save for the fact the Jacobites didn't press the government forces, who were numerically inferior to the rebels. 2. The problem that began to fall the rebel cause came when James, already under stress and strain from his arduous sea journey, came down with a bout of flu, and from Christmas Eve 1715 had to rest up in the Earl of Mar's castle, whilst he was desperate to get to Perth, where his loyal forces were concentrated. James entered Perth just before Hogmanay 1715 to a great deal of pomp and ceremony, and after a tour of the area, receiving plaudits from the populace and touching others to relieve the disease known as the King's Evil, he greeted his troops and met Mar, who he wrote back to Bolingbroke in France about, waxing lyrical on Mar's affection and reason towards the king. James then retired to the palace at Scone, which was the ancient location of Scottish coronation ceremonies for centuries. In line with this great tradition, James announced that January 23rd, 1716, would be his royal coronation. He was riding on a wave of optimism, but unfortunately, that lift in spirits was short-lived. James was here to lead his men, but he had no supplies of troops with him, which meant the army was no better off. James's war council also weren't reassured by their king's cheery reassurance that he'd been through hardships before, and that God could throw many more hardships at him, but he would endure. As an army that had fought one stalemate battle and then withdrawn to Perth, this wasn't exactly the rousing cry to victory they were after. As always, sectarianism had begun to raise its head as well. James, as his father and mother were before him, was a Catholic in a country that was Protestant in England, ruled by a Protestant minority in Ireland, and dominated by Presbyterianism, a sect of Reformed Protestantism, in Scotland. As we've said over and over, to call the Jacobite campaign Protestant versus Catholic is ridiculously simplistic, but we can't deny that this did play a role in the start of the struggle and throughout in people's perceptions of the two opposing parties. One of James's major faux pas came when the Scottish Episcopals, who were Protestants who favoured a church with clergy, as opposed to the Presbyterians, who had a distinct aversion to these power structures. The Episcopalians were a somewhat persecuted minority, as the Presbyterian faction had effectively sidelined them, over the fact Episcopal bishops felt that James was king, as his father had been. In exchange for backing the Jacobite forces, the Episcopal clergy were restored in Jacobite-controlled areas. In thanks, the Episcopal churches had held Te Deum services to give thanks to King James at St John's Kirk in Perth. James, however, refused to attend the Protestant service, which angered the congregation. James tried an exercise in damage limitation by publishing a very long text explaining his reasons for non-attendance. I'm not going to go into the whole thing, but in general he says he wouldn't attend a service or a faith that he didn't follow. His honour wouldn't allow him to lie to his people and abandon his Catholicism. The feeling you kind of get is that James is quite tired of answering these questions at this point, and he feels that his assurances to protect the Protestant faith should be enough. Problem for James is there were people alive who still remembered his father, James II and VII. He had, in their eyes at least, tried to reinstall Catholicism in England and Scotland. James's refusal to even attend a service held in his honour, even to just be polite, threw suspicion on his motives, and it alienated some support for the king and the Jacobite cause by extension. Now, despite this, the Jacobite army was still in good spirits. Their king was with them, they were numerically superior, and they held Perth. But the good old British winter was about to set in, and this one was particularly harsh. Everyone struggled to find food and fuel, but it's especially hard when you're trying to raise a rebel army. Some soldiers went home to get what they could for their families, which depleted the numbers even further, like a slow puncture in a tyre. The Duke of Argyll was aware of this, and he sat at Stirling Castle, waiting to make his move. Argyll wanted to get to Perth and take the fight to the Jacobites, but he was equally hampered by the weather. He knew the difficulties of trying to chase an army through the frozen highlands, and he therefore drew up plans for an assault, which he was going to keep in reserve, just in case it was needed. Argyll's initial gambit would be to offer clemency to the Jacobite rebels. Surrender, walk away, and there would be no pursuit. By offering the chance to walk away, Argyll chose to try and offer mercy to further deplete the Jacobite ranks. This strategy, however, was not greeted with approval by London and King George's government. As far as they were concerned, this rebellion needed stamping on hard and quick to show everyone who was in charge. To that end, they sent General William Cadogan and extra men, guns and money to Scotland. Aside from a spirited attempt by Father James Carnegie, a Catholic priest and Jacobite agent, who persuaded some Swiss mercenaries to defect, most in the Jacobite command could see the game was going to end. The government was massing for an all-out assault on Perth. The Jacobite War Council decided they were not prepared to make it easy, and in the hope of slowing or halting a government advance, recommended a scorched earth policy. James was initially reluctant, but was persuaded to sign an order for his forces to burn villages to the ground to deny the enemy anywhere to garrison. The 500 troops of Highland clansmen headed to Ochterarda, then Blackford, where they burnt all the properties bar the Maitland Inn, as the owner's son had guided them to town, and James Davidson's, as he'd put the fires out the minute the Jacobites left. Lord George Murray led troops to Crieff and Dunning. It was said he took dinner at the house of William Reed, a minister who had died hours before. After having his meal, George then allowed his Highland troops to burn the house. There were conflicting reports as to whether Minister Reed's bereaved family got their belongings out before the fires were set. Now, this wasn't by any means a tactic that was out of the ordinary for the time. Many armies operated similar, equally as harsh policies, if not more so than the Jacobite rebels. Modern standards of warfare, such as the Geneva Convention, were 300 years from even being invented. Sadly, at this time, everyone and everything tended to be considered fair game in a war. Even Argyll had said he would have pursued similar to defend Perth from the rebels. But the optics for the Jacobites were, to put it bluntly, awful. Burning the homes of those you're claiming to govern and protect from Hanoverian oppression and sending them homeless and hungry into a terrible winter is not a good thing. James clearly saw that this was, in fact, too high a toll to wage on the population when there was already a brutal winter to contend with. So the Jacobites and James then tried what modern politicians might call a damage limitation exercise. James asked for estimates to be prepared for future compensation, and he ordered that all be done to try and help people, even composing a letter to the Duke of Argyll, the commander of his army's opposing force, in February 1716. Now, I'm sure that's confusing. The head of the Jacobite court is writing to his enemy, so I should probably explain that due to the fact the Jacobites were stuck in Perth, with falling numbers and a government force on the way to confront them, the War Council was called with James and his senior advisers. There were those who felt that Perth could be fortified, using artillery and taking advantage of the frozen weather. The Jacobite war party felt they had a strong case, but the council overall lost its fight, and despite Highland and Irish objections, they made the decision to vacate Perth, convinced the government forces would outnumber James's army 2-1. James was absolutely distraught, not only at his army's decision, but that he was going without a fight. He wrote to his half-brother Berwick and Berwick's son the Duke of Lyria, stating he wished he could fight, but that he'd been convinced it would be useless by his council. Their plan was to link up with another force commanded by the Marquess of Huntly, where they could look to regroup and prep a new assault. Perth was finally abandoned by the Jacobites on January 30th, 1716. The troops left after jettisoning their cannons and supplies, marching across the frozen highlands towards Montrose. Argyll then marched into Perth on February 2nd and decided to set off in hot pursuit after the rebels. Argyle got within 3 miles of James, but after writing that letter to him, which stated he was leaving the country to preserve his men, as he'd been convinced by his commanders that the government would continue to be ruthless in their actions, James had decided it was time to cash in his chips and leave. Giving his letter to Argyle to a subordinate, who never sent it, James and a cadre of his loyal officers sailed out of Montrose on a French ship, the Marie-Thérèse, eventually joined by Lord George Murray and William Murray, the Marquess of Tullibardine, and others who fled to the safety of continental Europe. James left behind a modest amount of money to compensate the locals left homeless by his scorched earth order, but beyond that, the Jacobite army was on its own. The remaining Jacobites chose to abandon Montrose and make their way to Aberdeen. From there, they dispersed across the Highlands, rushing home to avoid reprisals or hiding until they could gain passage to Europe via ports in the Highlands and Islands. And thus, the Jacobite uprising of 1715 ended not in glorious triumph and restoration of the House of Stuart, but with James Stuart in flight and his army scattered to the winds. Given that we covered the events of 1715 and its battles in a relatively quick fashion before the Christmas break, I thought it might be best that we take a moment and have a sort of 1715 post-mortem, if you will, to give a full analysis of what went wrong. I say this because I honestly believe the Jacobites could have had a shot at taking on the Hanoverians and mounting a challenge, although I will have to concede there would have had to have been a hell of a lot of caveats. Whilst nowhere near as unpopular as James and his cabinet were led to believe, the Hanoverians were not the critically acclaimed people Whig scholars would have had them portrayed as later. William, Mary and Anne all had links to the throne, an English, Scottish, British ruling lineage, some of them more than others. But George I was a real stretch. He'd never been to Britain, he didn't speak the language, and frankly, a lot of the time he preferred to be in Hanover whenever Parliament let him. Let alone the fact that there were over 50 people who had a closer link who were only denied because of their Catholicism. The Jacobites could have mounted a decent rebellion, but they were hamstrung by several major factors. First, the most obvious geopolitical difference between the earlier campaigns and this one was the extreme limit of French logistical support. Louis XIV had been a key reason that fighting had prolonged from 1689. He utilised troops, ships and weapons to support his cousin to retake his throne, or at the very least cause England and the Netherlands as much of a headache as possible, while France furthered its own ambitions on the continent. Under Louis XV's regency, however, Britain and France had been in a state of relative peace, and Louis's regent, the Duc d'Orléans, was keen to keep trade with Britain open. War is understandably bad for business, so without their major planning partner, the Jacobites were really struggling to rally manpower and get enough of an army to ensure an easy victory. James's supporters were disappointed that he sailed to Scotland relatively empty-handed, but the Jacobite army at Sheriffmuir was still numerically superior, so clearly the quality of troops played as much of a role as the quantity. Whilst the government had reduced its troop numbers and many troops were raw recruits in the 1715, they were still professional soldiers with a minimum of basic training. But even that was better than most of the clansmen who were raised by their landlords to fight. These men were ordered to come, some of whom under threats of violence, and armed with nothing more than farm tools when they assembled. Unlike Argyle, Cadogan and their ilk, the men in charge of some of the Jacobite forces were either indecisive like Marr or incompetent like Forster. The Jacobites had competent officers, but those who professed loyalty to the cause often had higher standing and were promoted because of it. This led to a massively lacklustre performance against government forces. The Scottish Jacobite contingent fought to an inconclusive result at Sheriffmuir, but they were prevented from capitalising on the numerical advantage as Marr and their officers lost their nerve and refused to press their advantage against a government army that had been bashed around and barely ready to defend against an attack. The situation was even worse in England, where despite Mackintosh of Borlum and other experienced commanders, the sheer ineptitude of Thomas Forster as commander meant Preston was not only impossible to defend, but was surrendered against the wishes of many of its troops. These military failures were the death knell of any major offensives. The government rode roughshod in England and were beaten to a stalemate in Sheriffmuir, marching toward Perth to confront the Jacobites. Given the desertions for lack of food and supplies, by the time the King of the Stuarts arrived, there weren't enough people, to the opinion of their commanders, to mount a defence against a reinvigorated government force. That the Jacobites fought a scorched earth policy in the Highlands would have slowed down the troops of the Duke of Argyle, but it instead would have delayed the inevitable. with the added side effect of alienating the populace in the areas put to the flame. The public played an important role too, given that James was hoping for a groundswell of support from the populace to rise up and join the revolt against the Hanoverians. The problem was that whilst the people had rioted in opposition to George I's coronation, it bears stating that the protest of one doesn't automatically equate to endorsement of the other. Just because people weren't keen on George didn't mean that they wanted James. Sectarian divisions did play a role in this. People still remembered the reign of James VII and II, as well as his deposing by William and Mary. There was still a large distrust of Catholics, and James's motives were constantly being questioned, such as his non-attendance at the Te Deum service. There were fears, founded or unfounded, that James would try to re-establish Catholicism at the expense of the Anglican and Presbyterian churches. Keen to avoid this, many people stuck with the Whig government and King George, rather than the possible issues of James down the line, truly embodying the devil you know is sometimes better than the devil you don't. So what happened after the 1715 petered out? Well, James arrived in France and headed to Saint-Germain to see his mother, the former Queen Mary, and reform his court. The first thing he did was sacked Bolingbroke, whom he blamed for not sending any supplies. He was unaware of his philandering, nor his friendship with Lord Stair, the British ambassador. Bolingbroke was never a particularly astute or capable Secretary of State, and within 2 years he would eventually defect back to George and the House of Hanover, securing a royal pardon for his treason. The Whig government, whilst victorious, was somewhat taken aback by the level of support achieved. That the Jacobites had managed to rally thousands of troops was a major concern to the Hanoverian regime. The reprisals taken were swift, harsh, and decisive in order to stamp out any further dissent. Prisoners from the Jacobite army in Preston were marched to Chester, save for a few high-ranking prisoners who were taken directly to London. One of these was the young Earl of Derwentwater, who was taken to London and despite his wife pleading with King George for clemency and mercy, Derwentwater had pled guilty to the government and they were in no mood to tolerate dissent. On February 24, 1716, James Radcliffe, the third Earl of Derwentwater, was led to the scaffold at Tower Hill to be beheaded for treason. Just before he was to die, Derwentwater gave a speech in which he prayed for his immortal soul, then to apologise if anyone was upset by his pleading guilty, but that he was loyal to his Jacobite king and that no one else should suffer for his actions. This speech, his youth, and the dignified manner in which he met his end garnered a large amount of sympathy for Derwentwater and the Jacobite cause as a whole. He became, all in all, a useful propaganda tool as a young Jacobite martyr. Beheading was the punishment for nobility involved in treason. Unfortunately for the so-called common soldiers, the punishment in England was for the dreaded hanging, followed by being drawn down and then quartered. This happened to the soldiers in Preston and London, as well as some in Manchester who were just hanged. Many went to their deaths still proclaiming the Jacobite claimant to the throne as the true King of Britain. But there were some who managed to escape the executioner's wrath. Thomas Forster, the MP who'd led the doomed defence of Preston, skipped out of his cell at Newgate Prison after leaving to go to the toilet from drinks with the governor. A month later, in 1716, his subordinate at Preston, Mackintosh, and a gang rushed the guards in the exercise yard and broke out of Newgate. Another story concerning Lord Nithsdale was that his wife, Lady Nithsdale, had pleaded with King George for clemency, but he had refused. So she snuck in a wig and some makeup and smuggled her husband out of prison dressed as one of her maids. Up north in Chester Castle, the confined prisoners from Preston, owing to overcrowding and awful conditions, were suffering from many different diseases, and many were taken ill, with several dying. There were floggings and several escape attempts. For those interested in the fate of Charles Murray, the son of the Duke of Atholl, his story of his capture and his imprisonment at Chester is covered within Rosalind Anderson's The Jacobite Rising of 1715 and the Murray Family, which is well worth a read and has also helped gratefully in my writing of the post-war 1715 timeline. The government also decided its vengeance would stretch from England to Scotland. The issue the Whig government in London had with this was that there was a significant proportion of the population in Scotland who were sympathetic to the rebels. Since a major rallying point of the Jacobites was no union, and there was considerable opposition to the 1707 union between England and Scotland, there was a contingent of the people who wanted the rising to separate England and Scotland again, and if supporting the Stuarts achieved this, then so be it. The Duke of Argyll had argued for clemency to the rebels and a general amnesty to try and curry favour with the people for the Hanoverian regime, but the regime was in no mood to play, and they demanded that these people be treated as rebels and punished as such to the utmost. Scottish nobility were taken to London, but thanks to the terms of the Union, Scots retained their own legal system, and English lawyers were in no way prepared to take on their counterparts. Apart from the executions, many men were sentenced to imprisonment or transportation to the colonies, where they would work a minimum term of indentured servitude, though admittedly some of them were lucky enough to have their servitude papers bought by wealthy sympathisers who simply let them go. There was also a round of acts of attainder and confiscations of property, though again in Scotland these were frustrated by the courts, where lawyers tried to obstruct in many cases. But the guilty weren't the only ones to suffer. The Duke of Atholl, despite having had three rebel sons, had stayed loyal to London, but he complained his compensation from British troops ransacking Blair Castle had never turned up. His son William also officially lost the lands and the titles of the Marquess of Tullibardine. The Duke of Argyll, the man who pretty much saved Hanoverian rule in Scotland, lost all of his positions, power and influence, all for daring to ask the king for mercy. Eventually, of course, the government passed an act of indemnity in 1717. This act pardoned hundreds of Jacobites, except for those in exile, and rather noticeably, the entirety of Clan MacGregor, presumably to get back at Rob Roy MacGregor for his support of James. This would bring a legal end to a lot of people's imprisonments, and would show that the government was, after all, and after about 2 years' delay, being merciful. James, meanwhile, had decided once he returned to Europe, things were too hot for him to stay in his base in Lorraine. So after writing a letter thanking the Duke of Lorraine for his kind hospitality, and counselling with the Earl of Mar, whom he had replaced Bolingbroke with as Secretary of State, the Duke of Ormond, and his mother Queen Mary, James relocated the Jacobite court in exile to Avignon, now in modern-day France, but in Jacobite times was under the control of Pope Clement XI as part of the Papal States. The Jacobites had again lost their chance to claim the throne and would begin the long road again in our next episode as we begin our second interlude.